Good evening. It's great to be with you all again tonight. We're thankful for this opportunity, and I want to thank you again for the opportunity just to be with you this week. I don't have any greater pleasure in this world than sharing the gospel with those that love to hear it. So I've had a good time. I really enjoy these opportunities, and just thank you for providing it. And thank you for attending well and encouraging me in what we've been doing and talking about. As Norm said, being the kind of people that God designed us to be, that He deserves for us to be, to honor and praise Him and to glorify Him, that we might be in His presence in this life and for all eternity. And it's a wonderful thing to think about and challenge ourselves to. God's been so gracious. And I hope that some way, somehow this week, your mind has been turned to thinking about holy things, to thinking about your life and your relation with God, and striving to be more holy because He's holy. So thank you for this opportunity. It's great to be with Norm and Barbara Jo. I really appreciate them in so many ways. I'm glad that they're here with y'all. They are just tremendous servants, and they have this just great ability to elevate the quality of the service of others. And I tell you what, that's what you want, folks working with the congregation. They just have that amazing ability. Over the years, I've seen it over and over again, not only their service, but how they elevate others as well. So I'm very glad that they're here with you, and I pray that you'll have a good relationship in the time to come. Why don't you go back to the book of Nehemiah tonight with me, and we're going to be talking about still pursuing purity, which is a key aspect of holiness, of course. Nehemiah, you might think, is the last book in the Bible you'd go to think about pursuing purity. After all, he did was build a wall, right? What does that have to do with purity? Well, he's famous, of course, for rebuilding the wall around Jerusalem, but that's hardly his main intent, as we're going to see even this evening. His idea and his motivating concept was that God's people needed to be holy and pure. They need to be protected from the nations around about them so that they might serve God in His temple in a way that God would appreciate, let's say. And so he's really interested not just in building a wall for a wall's sake, but in securing the city and enabling the people to worship separate from the world around them, which is really kind of a big aspect of holiness. So he's living in the reign of Artaxerxes. A lot of the Jews have been released. All of them really could probably have gone back home, or many of them could. Some of them had jobs or things that kept them in the lands of captivity. Like Nehemiah, he was cupbearer to King Artaxerxes. And so he was still there in the land of captivity even after the Persians took over. And this was some good long time after the captives have been allowed to go back. But he gets a report that even many years after the captives have returned and the temple has been rebuilt, the walls of Jerusalem still lay waste. And the people of God are exposed to their enemies around. They are, in fact, a reproach to their enemies around. So Nehemiah prays a lot and gets permission from King Artaxerxes to go back. In fact, he gets help from King Artaxerxes to go back and rebuild the walls. I just want to notice a couple of things with you before we really get into our text this evening. Look at Nehemiah chapter 2. And he gets back and he looks at the walls toward the end of the chapter. And then he gets up with the leaders of the Jews back in Jerusalem. And he says to them in verse 17 of Nehemiah 2, "You see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste, its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach." And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, "Let us rise up and build." And they set their hands to this good work. Now when Sanballat, the Horonite, Tobiah, the Ammonite official, and Geshem, the Arab, heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us and said, "What is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king?" So I answered them and said to them, "The God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build, but you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem." I want you to notice a key aspect of holiness here that's driving Nehemiah. Separation. Do you see that? Separation from the people of the world. You people of the world, you don't have a part in what we're doing here. You're not going to have a part in what we're doing here. We're God's holy people. And so there's separation from the get-go is his idea for building the wall. I think that's an important concept that carries through the entire book. Nehemiah is an astounding character to me and one that is largely underappreciated in our Bible studies typically. But Nehemiah worked all of the work that he did, incredible work really, in view of eternity. He organized the rebuilding of the wall. He supported those who were working on the building of the wall. He fed a lot of people at his table at his own expense. He didn't exact taxes from the people, even though he was the governor and could have. And he mentions all of that and goes through all of that. And in Nehemiah chapter 5 and verse 19, somebody would say, well, why are you doing all of this, Nehemiah? Why are you so, you know, gung-ho about rebuilding these walls and making God's people the holy people they ought to be? And he says, as he prays to God in Nehemiah chapter 5 and verse 19, remember me, my God, for good according to all that I have done for this people. So Nehemiah is working to keep the people pure and to purify them, to build this wall and to do all that he's doing because he wants to be remembered by God. Remembered by God for pursuing purity. And that's what we'll be talking about tonight. You can do a lot of great things in this world. But most things that you do in this world will, in a generation or two to come, be entirely forgotten. And it hardly matters the fame and renown that you achieve, even if you're famous by worldly standards. In a few generations, people may know your name. They probably won't really know what you did. Right now, here tonight, I know the names of my grandparents. I kind of know the names of my great-grandparents. I do not know any of the names of my great-great-grandparents. Not one thing they did. They lived lives that were valuable. They did important things in their lives. I do not even know their names. I'm saying that to say what the wise man says in Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and verse 16. That there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever, since all that is now will be forgotten in the days to come. So whatever you do in this world is going to be forgotten in the days to come, unless you do it for God. Because here's the thing about God. God's memory is eternal. And if we're remembered by God, we'll be remembered forever. And God will reward us eternally. So Nehemiah is saying to God, remember me, God. For good. The Israelites may forget who helped them build that wall. But Nehemiah wanted God to remember him forever. And that's a great motivation and one that we'll get back to toward the end of the lesson. Well, turn in your Bibles now to Nehemiah chapter 13. And we're going to see Nehemiah working very diligently at the very last chapter of this book to pursue purity on his own behalf and on behalf of the people. Pursue purity to be remembered by God. As you open up the chapter, you see that many Israelites had been convicted by the law concerning keeping themselves separated from the people of the land. This is a good bit later after the wall had been built and some years later. On that day, though, they read from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people, and it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever come into the assembly of God, because they had not met the children of Israel with bread and water, but hired Balaam against them and to curse them. However, our God turned the curse into a blessing. You guys remember that story, right? Where the Israelites are coming up out of the wilderness wandering, and one of the first nations they come to is Moab, and the king of Moab, Balak, tries to get Balaam to curse the Israelites. Remember all that? And Balaam tries, but he can't even do it because God changes his words to turn them into a blessing. But what this passage is referring to is that the Israelites now, in Nehemiah's time, are reading Deuteronomy 23, apparently, where Moses instructed the children of Israel that no Moabite or Ammonite was to be admitted into the assembly of God's special people. And why? Because they hadn't helped the Israelites when they came up out of Egyptian bondage. Now, here's an interesting thing. That law, which is found in Deuteronomy 23, was right nearly 1,000 years old when these people read it in Nehemiah's time. And you know what? That didn't matter. It doesn't matter how old the law of God is. If it's still in effect, it doesn't matter if it's 1,000 years old, 2,000 years old. If we're going to be God's people, we're doing what God said. And that was the attitude of these people. It may have been 1,000 years ago, and lots of things have happened in Israel since then, both to the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Israelites. But their attitude was, we're keeping this law. And that was a good attitude. And Nehemiah encourages it. It says in verse 3, "So it was when they heard the law that they separated all the mixed multitude from Israel." So when this is done, though, something else really negative happens. That's a really good thing. But Nehemiah talks about something that happens before this time. Eliashib, the priest having authority over the storerooms of the house of our God, was allied with Tobiah. Now, you might remember Tobiah's name. I read it a minute ago from chapter 2. Tobiah is a Moabite. He is one of these folks that's not supposed to be among the children of Israel because they're not holy people. But look what had happened. Eliashib, the high priest, had prepared for Tobiah a room where previously they had stored the grain offerings, the frankincense, the articles, the tithes of grain, the new wine and the oil, which were commanded to be given to the Levites and singers and gatekeepers, and the offerings for the priests. During all of this time, I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I returned to the king. So he left king of Babylon, Artaxerxes, the Persian king, in the 20th year of his reign. Now this is the 32nd, so this is 12 years after the building of the wall. But he says, after certain days, I obtained leave from the king, and I came to Jerusalem and discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah in preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of God. I want you to feel the upsetness that Nehemiah is feeling about all of this. You know, ladies, have you ever, you know, baked a cake for some really special occasion, maybe a wedding reception or something like that, and you've got that thing, worked on it all day, and you've got that thing perfect, and it's a masterpiece, and you know, one of the kids comes through and runs his fingers through the icing because it looks so good, maybe even cuts a piece of it, and you know, you just pull your hair out, right? Because you work so hard to make this so beautiful and so right, and then it's disrespected. It's not right anymore because somebody's just carelessly messed it up. Nehemiah and the people have built this wall all the way around Jerusalem for the purpose of keeping the unholy people out so that they might worship as God deserved. And now you've got one of the leaders of those people, Tobiah, who's camping out in the temple. I mean, it's in a room for the storeroom for the Levites' provisions, adjacent to the temple. You might wonder what this picture is about. That would be my reaction too, I think. Because what Nehemiah does is he just goes off the reservation. And he just tosses all of Tobiah's stuff out of the room. You know, you see these commercials where some couple is having a fight and the woman throws all of the guy's stuff out the window and all that kind of stuff. That's what's going on here. I mean, he is upset about what has happened. And why? Because he has worked so hard to help this be a pure people in God's eyes. And now impurities come right into the middle of it. You see what the text says. It grieved me bitterly, verse 8, and therefore I threw all the household goods of Tobiah out of the room. And I commanded them to cleanse the rooms. Well, why would they do that? Again, it has to do with holiness, doesn't it? I commanded them to cleanse the roofs, and I brought back into them the articles of the house of God and the grain offering and the frankincense. Nehemiah was grieved. He evicts Tobiah. This whole incident reminds me more than a little bit of something that happened later on in this same second temple, although it had been refurbished a little by then, in the days of Jesus. Because Jesus goes into the temple, and what does he find? In John chapter 2, he finds people selling sheep and oxen and doves changing money. And he drives them all out. I wonder if he looked a little bit like Nehemiah does there. And he drives them all out. And he says, make not my father's house a house of merchandise. This is not the place for things that are not holy. You know, there's nothing wrong with selling a sheep for a sacrifice. There was nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with changing somebody's money out who's come from a foreign land and needs money to buy things with or pay the temple tax. Nothing wrong with that. The wrong was, it was in the wrong place. It wasn't a holy thing. There's so many people in the religious world today that don't understand this concept. You can't bring common things into the temple of God. It doesn't honor God. And it's not holy. That's what Nehemiah is concerned about. We need to be concerned about it too. Jesus was. You know, Jesus died. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 27 tells us that he might present to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. That's what the church is supposed to be. The church is the temple of God today. It's a spiritual temple. It's not this building. It's us. And we need to keep it pure. For the same reasons that Nehemiah was keeping that temple pure in those days. We also see in Nehemiah a great dedication to supporting the workers who worked in and among doing holy things. He says in verse 10 of Nehemiah chapter 13, I also realized that the portions for the Levites had not been given them, for each of the Levites and the singers who did the work had gone back to his field. Now, if you've been paying attention a little bit here, you know why that is. Because Tobiah had moved in to the room that stored their provisions. So there was no provision room for the Levites. So they didn't have anything to eat. They weren't given anything in the way of the tithes. The tithes were taken up for them. For, you know, to support them. That's what they were for. But they didn't have any of that. So they had to go out and work in the fields. And the services of the temple then were neglected because the Levites didn't have these provisions. So Nehemiah is working to correct that. The law of Moses required the Israelites to provide for the Levites. Deuteronomy 12 and verse 19, take heed to yourself that you do not forsake the Levite as long as you live in your land. That was God's expectation. And the reason was that the Levites were the ones who worked in the holy things, in the service of the temple later on, of course, the service of the tabernacle early. Nehemiah finds that the Jews are not supporting the Levites. And so he corrects the situation and he contends with the rulers. You see in verse 11, he says, I contended with the rulers. Why is the house of God forsaken? Here's the problem. You know, we've done all of this so we can worship God here in peace, and you guys have messed it up so bad we can't even have worship like we're supposed to because your priorities are out of kilter. You're not supporting the people who are taking the lead in these things. He says, I gathered them together. I set them in their place, talking about the Levites. Then all Judah brought the tithe of the grain and the new wine and the oil to the storehouse. And so he took care of the situation. And again, I think there's a parallel for us today. We are to provide for the preaching of the gospel. Why is that? Because it's a holy thing. And we're to uphold the hands of those who are working diligently to share the gospel. It's important. And you might be saying to yourself, well, Steve, I don't know about that. You can't really parallel, you know, the Israelite support of the Levites and the priests with, you know, supporting preachers today, that's apples and oranges. No, it's not. I can't do that, but the Apostle Paul could. So turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. I want you to notice this very carefully with me. Paul is talking about his right to be supported as a preacher of the gospel, although he didn't receive support from Corinth. He did from others, but not from them. But he's reasoning with the Corinthians about this. They're kind of slow to catch on. But he says in verse 7 of 1 Corinthians 9, whoever goes to war at his own expense, who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its fruit, or who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk of the flock? Do I say these things as a mere man? Or does not the law itself say the same? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Is it oxen that God is concerned about? Or does he not? Does he say it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he who plows should plow in hope, and he who threshes in hope should be partaker of his hope. If we have sown spiritual things for you, is it a great thing if we reap your material things? Paul's making an argument. You know, you should be supporting the preaching of the gospel. But I want to go a little bit further with you and see the parallel that he makes in verse 13. Do you not know that those who minister the holy things, who would those people be? The Levites and the priests. That those who minister the holy things eat of the things of the temple, and those who serve at the altar partake of the offerings of the altar. Even so, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should live from the gospel. Paul parallels those two things. I can make a lot of comments about this. Norm didn't ask me to preach on this, so I can just, you know, y'all aren't going to raise my salary or lower it or whatever, so I can just kind of say what I want to. Somebody, you know, I've heard arguments over the years about how much the preacher should be paid. I don't know if y'all got any of those here, but I've heard them. So there's lots of different opinions about that. I tell you what the preachers were paid in the Old Testament. I know exactly how much. It was 120% of what everybody else made. The reason that I know that is because everybody else was to give a tenth of all that they had to support the Levites. The Levites also had to give a tenth. So 12 tribes, 10% from everybody, that's 120% if my math is right, of what everybody else made. That's just a ballpark figure. If you want to pay a preacher that would be good, I think. Paul makes the parallel. Now, why am I saying all this? I'm not really working for increasing preacher salaries in America. They're fine by and large. I'm very well supported in all that I do for the Lord. But I do think it's important for y'all to realize that when you support a preacher, you're pursuing holiness. If he's a good man and he's working for the Lord diligently, you're supporting holiness. You're pursuing holiness. You understand that? These people that work in the house of God so diligently. And it doesn't matter. I see you're supporting Elias over in Zimbabwe. He is a fine, fine man. You are doing a good work in helping support a man like that. He is a holy man, and he's doing good work in the Lord. And so that's the kind of thing I want to encourage you to do. That's what, going back to Nehemiah, that's exactly what he's doing. He's saying, we've got to support holiness here. We need to support these gospel preachers. And in supporting God's workers, it made Nehemiah a fellow worker. I want you to look at Nehemiah chapter 13 and verse 14 now. As again he turns to God and he says, "Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and do not wipe out the good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for its services." Supporting the Levites regarding the services. He says, "Remember me, God, for this, because I pursued holiness in supporting the work of those who do the spiritual work." The same principle applies today. The Lord adds that to your account. Paul commends the Philippians. You know, I don't seek the fruit for me, he says, but it's to your account that these things are added. Well, let's go on in the book of Nehemiah chapter 13. And notice that we get to verse 15, and Nehemiah says, "In those days I saw people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath, bringing in sheaves and loading donkeys and wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them about the day on which they were selling provisions." Well, as I'm sure we all know, buying and selling, carrying burdens on the Sabbath, was a no-no in the Old Testament under the law of Moses. Under the law of Moses, the Sabbath day was a holy day. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. When Sabbath law was violated, it was a matter of God's people not being holy. Nehemiah is pursuing holiness. And so, again, he's upset. And as governor of the land, he's going to correct this. The law was Exodus chapter 20, that the bearing of burdens, the buying and selling of things was forbidden. Even animals were to rest on the Sabbath day, according to Deuteronomy 5:14. When Nehemiah witnesses people doing all of this kind of work, he says in verse 16, he saw even men of Tyre dwelt there who brought fish and all kinds of goods and sold them on the Sabbath to the children of Judah and in Jerusalem. And so in verse 17, he says, I contended again with the nobles of Judah and said to them, what evil thing is this that you do by which you profane the Sabbath day? To profane is to make something that is holy common. And that's what was going on. So Nehemiah stopped people from working on the Sabbath. And it's interesting the way he goes about it. I mean, there's no halfway with Nehemiah. There's no, I'm just sort of kind of going to support holiness. You know, this y'all are going to be holy. And he was extraordinarily insistent in a good way. Look what he says. He reminds the nobles that the wrath of God had come on them previously because they hadn't kept the Sabbath. That's part of the reason they'd gone into captivity. But he says in verse 19, so it was all the gates of Jerusalem, as it began to be dark before the Sabbath, I commanded the gates to be shut, and I charged that they must not be opened until after the Sabbath. And I posted some of my servants at the gates so that no burdens would be brought in on the Sabbath. Now the merchants and the sellers of all kinds of wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice, and I warned them, and I said to them, why are you spending the night around the wall? If you do that again, I will lay my hands on you. And he didn't mean that in a good way. He did not mean that in a good way. And so he says, from that time on, they came no more on the Sabbath. And I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves and that they should go and guard the gates to sanctify the Sabbath day. And again, there's that word, sanctify, right? To make holy. And then see what Nehemiah says in the last part of verse 22. Remember me, O my God. You see what I'm doing here, God? I'm pursuing holiness. Could you remember me? Great work that Nehemiah did. Again, we need to do the same today. There are a lot of ways to apply this principle. I think of eating common meals, enjoying one another's company in our homes as we share food together at a potluck somewhere or something like that. That's a fine activity. Making that a part of the work of the church has no place. Has no place. And so, you know, Paul says, if anyone's hungry, let him eat at home. That's where you're supposed to do that. The Lord's Supper, there's a time and a place. Right? First day of the week. With Christians in the church. Time and place have a lot to do with holiness. What's appropriate. I think you see that in all of these references. And then, really the fourth point I want to look at in Nehemiah 13 is that purity has to be maintained. Believe it or not, we come to Nehemiah 13 in verse 23. And Nehemiah says, in those days I saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Now you might remember we started the chapter with they separated themselves from those people. And I don't know exactly the time frame, but this comes up two or three times in Nehemiah and at least once in Ezra during this same time frame where the people had intermarried with folks they weren't supposed to intermarry with. And it affected them. It profaned them. It caused them to be unholy. And that's Nehemiah's concern. I see the people have intermarried with these folks. And he says in verse 24, half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of one or the other people. And I just want to tell you this, families of Christians, families of those of us who are God's chosen race, God's special people. You have to live in the world. Your kids have to live in the world, but they do not have to be of the world. And the way the world dresses and the way the world acts and the way the world talks, especially as we're looking at this verse, cannot be the way God's chosen people talk. We touched on this a little bit last night. But God's chosen people, holy people, Don't use the language. Don't say the kinds of things that people in the world accept and use every day. I'll give you a simple example of this. And it kind of illustrates how the language of Ashdod has come into the vocabulary of a good number of Christians. As I look on social media, I see this little abbreviation, OMG. You see that a lot? OMG stands for Oh My God. And it's just taking God's name in vain. It's what it stands for. And yet it's been, you know, just kind of accepted among us in some places at some times. I'd like us to think about that. Why do we say that? Is that a holy thing to say? Is it reverencing God? I don't think it is. And those are the kinds of things we need to be careful about. Somebody said, well, that's a little, you know, that's just, people aren't meaning to be disrespectful. Well, a lot of things that are disrespectful to God aren't meant to be, but are anyway, because they're not according to His will and His word, and they don't reverence Him. That's the language of Ashdod. That's where we've become so intermingled with the world that we can't express ourselves without saying it the way the world does. And we need to be cautious about those kinds of things. The Jews had intermarried. Foreign influence has caused their children to be unable to speak the language of Judah. And we need to be careful about the language of Ashdod ourselves. Over in the book of Ephesians, Paul will say in chapter 5 and verse 3 that foolish talking and coarse jesting should not even be named among us. So Nehemiah rebukes the people of his day. He reminds them that Solomon, the wisest man, was influenced to do evil, a lot of evil, because he was connected with the world, because of the influences of the foreign women that he married. And if Solomon could fall, he's telling them, you can fall too. And in no uncertain terms, he tells them to repent. And when he finishes all that in verse 29, he says, remember them, O my God, because they've defiled the priesthood. I want you to notice he's asking God to remember people who were not holy and to reward them accordingly. And then the very last line in the whole book of Nehemiah, he says, remember me, O my God, for good. Remember me, O my God, for I have pursued holiness. That's in essence what Nehemiah is saying. It's a great thing when somebody remembers you for something good that you've done. Every person who's ever lived, every action they've ever done, thought they've ever had, word they've ever said, will be remembered by God. Everything. Except for the things that you've done that were wrong, that have been washed away in the blood of the Lamb. And those things, God has said, I will remember no more. But to be remembered for good, and to be remembered for good eternally, is something that, like Nehemiah, I want. I hope you do as well. Our works will follow us, Revelation 14 and verse 13 says. We will be judged according to our works, Revelation chapter 20 and verses 12 and 13 says. And in Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 10, the writer says that God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love which you've shown toward His name. If you work hard in this life, you pursue holiness, you strive to be the kind of person, as we sing in the song, if I walk in the pathway of duty, if I work to the close of the day, I will see the great King in His beauty when I've gone the last mile of the way. In Luke chapter 23, Jesus is dying on a cross. And there are two thieves that are dying with him. And one of them, at the end of the conversation, says in Luke 23 and verse 42 to Jesus, "Lord, remember me when you come in your kingdom. Remember me." And Jesus said to him, "Surely I say to you that today you will be with me in paradise." Paradise is an interesting word. It's found exactly three times in the Bible. It doesn't come from either the Hebrew or the Greek. It is a Persian word. It is a word that Nehemiah, who worked in the court of a Persian king, would have heard. Paradiso. And what it means literally is a wall around. A wall around. And the idea is that rich people like kings would have, you can think of an English garden or something like that, and they'd put a wall around it. And it was this beautiful space where people could come into the presence of the king, or the king could spend time with his loved ones. And that was paradise. And Nehemiah went to Jerusalem, and at the place that the people of God would go to meet God, he built a wall around. And when in the book of Revelation, John sees the heavenly city, one of the first things he notices about it is that there's a wall around. That's paradise. I don't know what paradise is to you. When I think of the word, I think of a tropical island somewhere. I guess if you were in the hurricane right now, you wouldn't think of that. But normally we think of some tropical island somewhere. That's paradise. I'd like to be there, yeah. A couple of years when I was a youngster, I lived on what I think most people would consider to be a paradise, a tropical island. The island of Okinawa. Beautiful island. Palm trees, banana trees. I can still remember the cherry blossoms on the hillsides. The Okinawans working in the beautiful rice paddies. We had a house that was right on the ocean shore. In fact, a coral reef came up to our backyard. I remember lying awake at night, looking out my window, which faced the ocean, and watched as the octopus fishermen would float their little boats over the reef at high tide. And they'd have little lanterns in their boats as they were fishing, you know, and the boats and the lanterns looked like stars floating on the water. I couldn't go out on the reef by myself. I was too little. But I remember days when Dad would come home and he'd take my hand and he'd say, "Let's go." And we'd go walk out on the reef and we'd see, you know, the purple starfish and the sea urchins inching along in the tidal pools. And Dory and Nemo swimming along, you know. Fish like that were actually there. I remember that. And I can still, sometimes as I think about all of that, sort of feel the sea breeze in my face and smell the salt air and feel the warmth of my daddy's hand. But that's not paradise to me anymore. Used to be. I think someday, maybe someday soon, I'll awake in a land that's evergreen and walk along a golden shore and come face to face with the one who loved me and died for me. And in that moment of time, there's only one thing that I want to say to him. There's only one thing that I want to ask. And it is this: remember me. My friends, let us work for holiness, to be remembered by God forever. May we each determine to devote our lives to that. And one day, not only will we see his face, but one another's faces as well. If there's one here tonight who's subject to the invitation of Jesus Christ, who who has not been living a holy life or who would like to begin to live a holy life. His blood can wash you clean. Take advantage of it. Name the name of Jesus. If you've not been baptized for the remission of your sins and you need to be tonight, do that. If you're a Christian who's living in sin, don't do that. Don't come here and worship Him when you've got dirt on your garment. Come in the white robe that He's cleansed for you. We'd ask you to come while we stand and while we sing.
I have decided to follow Jesus. I have decided to follow Jesus. I have decided to follow Jesus.
Johnny Lewis will lead us in prayer. I appreciate everyone being here tonight. We do have a good attendance, and I think it can be said that we were helped by being here with the worship of God and the lesson that we've heard tonight. I appreciate it so much, and I appreciate Steve and Sandy and what they do in the Lord's kingdom. Steve has always brought to the scriptures for me an enlightenment, an illustration that helps me better understand it, and he's done that this week. And I think in doing so, he's helped move us to be better people and better servants of the Lord. And I appreciate him so much and the work that he does. And we wish him Godspeed and him going forward and continuing the work that he does at Eastside in Athens. I also know that when you hold a meeting and you're driving up every night, you're still doing all your local work, and then you're driving up to the meeting every night, it makes for a long week, it makes for a challenging week. But I appreciate him doing that every night. And Sandy, his wife, has had a number of health problems over the past couple of years, and that means he's got to leave her at home to come up here. And I appreciate him and appreciate her for making that sacrifice very much. So let's continue to keep Steve and Sandy in our prayers and for the work that they do. Is there anything we need to announce before we leave this evening? All right, if not, Johnny will lead us in prayer and then we'll be dismissed.
But I tell you, I do find that their relationship goes. know, the King of Islands or something. I don't know. Yeah, it's good to find him. He's got an apartment. You can look out and see the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, I haven't gotten on there yet. When we record them, and they're really big files, and our website won't accept them that way. So I've got to minimize all of them and then load them up there. And I just haven't had time to go through the minimization process. I hope not. I don't think it is, but I'm hoping I can get them up there tonight and do that. Yeah, I'll try to get them up there, if not tonight, the next few days. So. Okay, I'll try. Thank you, ma'am.